KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org. Oh.
If you're an NRA member, I think it's important for you to contact your NRA representatives and tell them they need to be part of the process. They can make this bill work.
There's really not a typical day in Afghanistan, but I've had some pretty good days.
Death is that great mystery that if I think about it in terms of our traditions, at least at an intellectual level, doesn't seem so scary.
We're going to talk about death today and taxes. I guess we've got the gamut covered today on Weekday. I'm Steve Scher, and in the middle, war. So there you are. That was one of the three interfaith amigos, Pastor Don McKenzie, talking about mortality. They'll be joining us a little later. Chris Frizonki talking about her life as a diplomat in Afghanistan. She was a Garfield High School graduate. And State Representative Mike Hope talking about House Bill 1588, which will require background checks for people who buy firearms. We're in week six of the state legislative session in Olympia. It's been slow. Glacial, I believe, is how some reporters are putting it, including Jerry Kornfield, reporter and political columnist for the Everett Herald. Jerry, good to talk to you again.
Hey, good morning. Good to talk with you.
Yeah, glacial, people are saying, the pace of legislation in Olympia right now. Is that how it feels to you?
I think it feels that way because the last few sessions have been pretty intense with budget deficits and politics. I think I attribute it to a 2012 hangover, you know, the election season, new faces, and new governor. New dynamic and power, and the checks and balances of power just has everybody moving just a little more cautiously.
Well, we do have this question about gun control legislation, and we heard Representative Mike Hope there talking about his House bill, which would require background checks. What's the status of these bills?
Well, that one in particular and is at 10 a.m. this morning is going to be considered by the House Judiciary Committee in terms of executive session. This is when they're expected to vote it out of committee and keep it alive. I know there's been some changes along the line and along the way, and there'll be some more changes on the wording. And so it will be interesting to see if everybody who signed on, including Representative Hope, sticks with the bill after all the changes. So, but that's probably one of that one and another bill from Representative Hope that would create a registry for law enforcement officers so that if you're convicted of a crime involving a weapon, you'd register, and only law enforcement agencies could see that information. That one seems pretty popular. Those are the two bills right now that seem to be advancing.
I'm surprised that one's popular. That's a gun registry. There's not a lot of organized opposition to those?
Well, there's opposition, but they're trying to write it in a way that says nobody can see it except for cops, and then it would go away after a certain number of years. But it's, I think the intention is that they'll be able to check in one place and see if the person they're talking to has ever used a gun involved in a crime, and then those who register would have to kind of check in with law enforcement periodically along the lines of those, say, like a sex offender. The big difference is there won't be a public list where someone can go and see if their neighbor has ever been arrested and involved with a gun.
Why is there a question of whether Mike Hope, who put the background check bill together, might not sign on? What kind of changes have been made to the bills?
I think he'll stick with it, but he is under pressure from some folks in his own caucus to oppose it. There are other law enforcement members of the legislature and the House that don't like it. And, you know, there is some language in there, without trying to get into the weeds, but that people pointed out to him might give law enforcement a little too much power to go in and inspect and check people. And they're trying to convince him that, you know, all the things he wants to accomplish have already there on the books. I don't think he'll change his vote, but I know he's under more pressure than most because he is a member of the Republican caucus as well as an NRA member. So he's getting his ear bent.
Jerry Kornfield is a reporter and political columnist for the Everett Herald. The governor said there should be a vote right away on the Reproductive Parity Act. He wants it to happen, maybe Friday. He drew the line on this one. It's sort of his first big statement on that. Political, but also does he expect it to have trouble passing?
Well, it is going to have trouble passing out of the legislature and reaching him. I get the sense he's rattling his saber a little bit and a little odd that he's chosen this as opposed to an economic issue. But the House of Representatives should vote on the bill this week, maybe on Friday, and then they'll send it to the Senate, where it doesn't seem like it's going to get out of the Senate. He's trying to bring pressure upon the Senate, and it would help him, I think, if the House would move on their bill. Then the public can focus their attention on the, you know, handful of pro-choice Republican members and try to convince them that this bill is worth them breaking ranks and joining Democrats to pass it. At this point, there's no signs that that coalition in the Senate is going to break ranks over this bill or any other major social issue.
How is the Senate being run by that coalition, Republicans and Rodney Thom, and the House, run by Democrats, sort of the more traditional people in charge these past few sessions? How are they pacing themselves comparatively, and how are they getting along?
Well, the relations at this point are usually the two chambers kind of ignore each other at this point. They send a few bills back and forth, but the real negotiating is still about 40 or 50 days away when the budget comes out. I think I would give the Senate Majority Coalition there above average, maybe a B minus so far, maybe a B. They've hung together in terms of passing several bills, workers' compensation reform and school construction, sort of topping the list. They've sent them over to the House. They've been more active on the floor with their legislation until probably yesterday, when the State House passed a bunch of bills. So they seem to be keeping together. Now, there is a rift in the ranks there on some issues like the Reproductive Parity Act, but the members are looking to the greater good, if you will, and not falling apart. The House, it's the chamber of Speaker Frank Chop, and he's moving things along at his pace, and I think it's looking pretty much like it has the last few years. Governor Jay Inslee's had a hands-off approach at this point. He's not sort of dived into the whole process the way his predecessor, Governor Chris Gregoire, did. He's not the policy wonk that she was. So I think he's going to be a backroom, a backbencher for a while. And we'll watch the two chambers see which, pass bills back and forth.
Did she dive in her first term? I know she did her second term specifically, but her first term, was she holding back a little bit?
I don't, not initially. I mean, she really did dive in. And here's a good measuring stick. They both are facing a major transportation funding package in their first session. And Governor Gregoire was right down there, if you will, twisting arms on the last day to move this, what was a 9.5-cent phased-in gas tax increase. And she did that in 2005. Now, tomorrow, House Democrats are going to put out a 10-cent gas tax increase. Not sure how they're going to phase it in over the coming years. If he is going to get on board with that and help move it, he's given no signs that he will. But if he does, it'll be an interesting test and a barometer of which governor could move a gas tax increase in their first session.
Now, speaking of transportation, the governor is going to name, theoretically, he's going to name a new transportation secretary either today or tomorrow. Today, right?
Yeah. I've heard that today he will put out make a decision on transportation secretary. It's not been confirmed or denied by his office. My gut tells me he's not going to keep the current secretary, but I've been wrong before, and that he's not shown any sort of made any public statements endorsing or embracing the work of Paula Hammond, the current secretary. Lawmakers have been frustrated with her and some of the leadership there involving the state ferries. So. I suspect he'll make an announcement, and it won't be her.
And also, as you mentioned, Judy Cliburn, House Transportation Committee, saying she's going to seek a 10-cent per gallon increase in the state's gas tax. Any support on the Republican side in the Senate for that?
Well, in the Senate or in the House, I think it's going to be hard to find support. What is unusual about this proposal is, there's no Republicans scheduled to be standing with her at the press conference tomorrow. Now, there may be some, I suspect there'll be some business leaders, there'll be some transit service supporters. So she'll have some coalition of folks there saying they'll help. But Republicans aren't at this stage. And usually it's a bipartisan group that needs to come together to move a gas tax or a major revenue package. So this will be a test for her and the governor to figure out if this is the way they're going to go. They're going to need to find some votes. And in particular, they need a two-thirds majority if they're going to try to pass a gas tax. And if it gets too hard, they'll have to punt it to the ballot, and where at least the voters on a simple majority can approve it up or down.
Jay Kornfield's our guest. He writes for the Herald and Everett. You mentioned education there and that school construction funding. The Republicans in the House have talked about changes to the system before they put more money into the system, changes in the way teachers are evaluated, change in the way principals can move teachers around, changes in the way the overall system would be evaluated. Where's that going?
You know, that's an interesting question, because it seems to be in the Senate side, they seem to be moving these reform bills quickly, but they all have big price tags, and they've yet to even say publicly how they will pay for it. And this is going to be a big fight down the stretch, and they will probably have to wait till March and to see when the budget proposals come out. The House has been much more sort of slow-paced, and their focus has been on coming up with new revenue. And again, that hasn't really surfaced. This is a budget battle, because at the end of the day, if they want more revenue on the Democrat side, or they're going to pay with existing revenue on the Republican side, it's going to affect the bottom line of the state. The state budget today cannot afford all of the investments in education that Republicans want to make. But the Democrats may not have the taxpayer support to raise the revenue they want to get. So they're going to have to. That's going to be the key budget battle.
They're also holding off on any funding or getting rid of the Family Leave Act funding.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those bills that was well-meaning and well-intentioned when it was passed, and then every year they put it on hold because there's no funding to make it happen. And you know, the linchpin has always been getting the employers and the employees to pay the tab and coming up with a way to do that. It was originally talked about going to the ballot and asking for folks to approve it as part of our paychecks. So you know, the Democrats want to keep it on the books. They don't want to forget about it. The Republicans say, you know, why do we have things written into law for programs that at this point we have no way of starting? And I think there's some logic to that argument. If you want to do it, bring it up when you can afford it, but let's get rid of it now so we don't have it hanging over our head. And there's one thing in state government, if it's on the books, then each year of the budget, they have to kind of start with, they have to assume that they're going to pay for it until they suspend it or get rid of it. And so this is one of those where the Republicans are saying, let's just get rid of it so we don't have to worry about it.
Also looks like the GET program survives another year, and differential tuition is not going to be taking place in the state, at least not this session.
Well, the House passed a bill that would say no to differential tuition, and the intention being that will help sustain the GET program. There's still going to be some discussions about whether the state budget has to add a little money in there to keep it going, or whether there has to be any changes in what parents pay for each unit. And so I think that will probably be decisions down the road. But what's interesting, I think, about the differential tuition is the lawmakers have consistently tried to sort of, maybe my word might be too strong, but they seem to meddle in higher education a little bit, probably too much for the university's liking. On the one hand, they tell them how much they can raise tuition, then they tell them what kind of tuition they can or can't have, and the universities are reaching the point where they're throwing their arms up and their leadership saying, hey, guys, let us try to operate for 1 year without you guys telling us what to do. So we'll see but I think they will be told no differential tuition, because it inherently doesn't sound fair that a student who enrolls to be an engineering student should pay a higher amount than a student who enrolls to be an English major. It just doesn't sound fair, and that's why they don't want to see it happen.
All right, Jerry, I appreciate you talking to us again.
Hey, well, thanks. Anytime. It'll start getting more interesting come March, which isn't that far away.
No, that's for sure. Jerry Kornfield is reporter and political columnist for the Everett Herald, joining us to talk about week 6 in Olympia. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW Seattle, the Three Interfaith Amigos, coming up.
KUOW's Katie Sewell engages the Three Interfaith Amigos in a conversation about religious perspectives on the afterlife in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Sutter Home and Hearth, featuring our annual winter celebration during the month of February, providing gas and wood-burning fireplaces and stoves designed for energy efficiency, gas logs, and accessories. Showroom in Seattle and on the web at SutterHearth.com.
43 degrees in Seattle. We've got partly cloudy skies, a little bit of sun as well. Forecast says it's going to be partly sunny today with a predicted high of 49. I'm Bernard Wollat. It's 9:20. And if that weather outlook makes you want to take a hike this week, stick around. We've got a suggestion for a hike to match the weather in 30 minutes.
Death, something we all need to grapple with, yes, and taxes. The three interfaith amigos join us with a look at what the different religions have to say about mortality and the afterlife, the three major monotheistic religions. They'll also talk about the common accusation of the non-religious that God is just a story people made up to feel better about life and death. Imam Jamal Rahman is co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at Interfaith Community Sanctuary, also adjunct faculty at Seattle University. He is also adjunct faculty. Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation, spirituality, founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Bet Aleph, meditative synagogue in Seattle. And Pastor Don McKenzie is a former minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. They're not here because Katie Sewell just talked to them, a couple days ago?
Just a couple days ago, and I started the conversation asking them a really personal question. Where are you on your personal journey when you consider your own death? And Imam Jamal Rahman answered first.
So, you know, it's a truism that death happens because of birth. And the fact that we are reluctant to look at death because we're scared of living fully. Mm-hmm. For me, when I think of death, I think of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as a model. And he mentioned two things which really splashed in my heart. One insight he had is that it is better to blush in this world than in the next world. And that really resonates. That really makes me realize, am I making my life meaningful? I'm thinking of this Bengali poet, Tagore, who said, you know, you spend your days and nights stringing and unstringing your instruments, but the song you came here to sing remains unsung. So at this stage of my life, I think of those things, that things that are meaningful. The second thing Prophet Muhammad said is that, you know, what really matters in a person's life is doing righteous deeds. Those two words appear again and again and again in the Quran. Righteous deeds. Will you be mindful of doing righteous deeds? You know, you can have wealth and money, but you leave them in the palace. You can have beautiful family and friends. They'll go as far as the grave. But beyond that, it is righteous deeds. So those two things keep me alive in my time of my life journey.
What do righteous deeds qualify as?
I think of Prophet Muhammad who said, do good things according to your capacity. God never tires of giving rewards unless you tire of doing good things. And the righteous deeds most loved by God are the ones that are done regularly, no matter how small they are. That is a constant reminder to me. Can you do it regularly, Jamal, no matter how small they are?
Do you have a personal example?
Well, for example, you know, I remember a good friend who used to always give money to homeless people, but would never question, you know, will they spend it on wine or on drugs? You do it for the sake of God. Any amount of money I have, which I feel I can spare, because the Quran says, give freely of what you love, you know, it needs to have some substance. So I'm willing to give it without questioning. That's a small act, for example. Or a good smile. Or as always remember, the Prophet Muhammad said, you know, the greatest thing you can do is just gladden the heart of another human being, if you can.
Don, what would you say? Where are you on your personal journey when you consider dying?
I have found that as some friends are becoming sick and dying, and as I, you know, lose parents, for example, I find that the way I look forward is different from the way it used to be. I don't know if I'm more or less invested in looking forward than others, but I think when I was younger, I looked forward to something hopeful. Who knows what? I'm not sure I could have said specifics. But I find that as I grow older, the whole way I look forward is changing from something involving doings and havings to something more spiritual. I've been sick a couple times and almost died once, and I'm not sure if I've really come to terms with that. Death is that great mystery that if I think about it in terms of our traditions, at least at an intellectual level, doesn't seem so scary. But when you get down to it, there's such a big mystery there that it requires some intentional spiritual practices and so forth. And we do live in a culture that really does its best to deny the reality, of death.
Well, when you say you're looking forward and it's becoming more spiritual, what does that mean?
Well, the road ahead is shorter than it used to be, you know. And I give thanks for people who have been examples for me who have died. I call them the lights on the road ahead. So instead of thinking about the future in terms of what I'm going to do, where I'm going to be, what I'm going to have, and so forth, I begin to think about it in terms of, or just wonder about it, in terms of, you know, that great question that we rarely ask, at least not out loud, what does happen when we die? What does happen? Of course, I don't know what happens. You know, we have only the wisdom of our traditions that suggest the fact that life does not end with death. What that means, we don't know. I mean, it's been talked about in very literal terms. It's been talked about in very abstract terms. But there is something that existed before I was born and something that will exist after I die. I don't know what that is.
Ted, Rabbi Ted, what do you say? What would you say?
I don't want to talk about it.
Too bad, pal.
You know, it is interesting to me as I listen to Pastor Don and talking about the shift. You know, as the road ahead is smaller than the road behind, I'm aware that there's a part of me, the ego part, the separate self, that gets afraid. And that's the part that doesn't want to talk about it. That's the part that doesn't want to look at it. That's the part that just doesn't want to think about my friends dying or the people who are close to me. Doesn't want to realize that my closest relationships, you know, one of us is going to leave first. And that's the way it is, which on an ego level, we have two ways of dealing with it. One is a relatively unhealthy way of denial, pretending it's not happening. And the other way, which is more healthy, is really striving to honor the moment, you know, so that the connections, that which is shared, becomes even more precious and even more special. And, you know, to have that sense of, it's just wonderful. And there is a self bigger than the ego. And that self sees birth and death in a larger context. You know, my tradition teaches that we are vehicles for a soul which is bigger than our separate self. The soul is on a larger journey. And to the extent to which we have, the word I often use is informed our soul, connected to our soul level, is I think the connection to which there is less of a fear of that passage and more of a sense of curiosity and a sense of wanting to take the very best of myself to leave, you know, to celebrate life, mm-hmm. and to witness. My favorite story, which I inevitably tell at memorial services, and I'll do it a little more quickly, is about the rabbi who, before teaching, his students went into his office, closed the door, and some moments later reappeared and somehow had a greater sense of confidence. When he grew older, he stopped closing the door quite so tightly, and the students would peek in to see what he was doing. And he was sitting at his desk and reaching into the lower left-hand drawer and taking out a black book. And he would open it, and he would study. And at a certain point, he would nod his head, close the book, put it back in the drawer, and get up. You know, the students would run back to their seats. Came time for that rabbi teacher to make his transition, to leave his body. And after the funeral, students from various years rushed back to the classroom because they knew what they wanted to see. What was it that he was looking at, studying every day before class? And the bravest among them rushed, came in and actually sat down in his chair, reached into that lower left-hand drawer, pulled out the book, opened it up. Every page in that book was blank except one page. And on that page, there was one sentence. And the sentence said, "Remember the difference between the container and that which it contains." Mm. Remember the difference between the container and that which it contains. And when I look at death, that's how I look. Mm. The container, each of us is an absolutely unique container that only comes once.
You know, Brother Ted, Katie, can I pick up on one point Brother Ted mentioned?
Yes.
I think it's critical to point out. You know, if we believe that we are nothing more than our personality,
right,
which is nothing more than a bundle of conditioned reactions to life circumstances, if we believe we're only our personality and we don't have a higher self, Christ nature, Elohim nature, Allah nature, Buddha nature, if we believe it's only personality, then all we want in life is to just run after scraps of pleasure, accumulate more things, and live lives of quiet desperation. And this is what all the great sages in Islamic spirituality say, that the greatest sadness a person has upon death, who believes that, is that this person says, "My goodness, I have not tasted the water of my own essence. I never connected with who I really am. And for that reason, I was always involved in trivialities, dramas, melodramas, never quite got into what the great sages say, being in the center of the wheel. The wheel goes up, the wheel goes down, that's life. But I have that feeling of that abiding equanimity, that joy, because I'm in the center of the wheel. I get to know who I really am."
There was a book by a columnist in Los Angeles when I lived in Los Angeles. And the book came from a letter that he had received, and it said, "Spend all your kisses, Mr. Smith." And I have that sense of, you know, have I hugged enough?
Yes.
Have I loved enough? Have I shared enough?
Yes.
You know, and the ultimate answer is going to be no. You know, because in that way there's never enough. And the answer is also yes.
I'm speaking with the three interfaith amigos. That was Rabbi Ted Falcon. You also heard Imam Jamal Rahman and Pastor Don McKenzie's here. Did you want to add anything to the train that they were just on? No,
I depend on my colleagues for one. I think that was terrific, yeah.
See, that shows he's beyond his personality. He has the divine quality of modesty and humility flows through him.
Well, there are so many questions I want to ask. But I did want to touch on that one of the main criticisms that you hear about religious faiths are that it's a made-up story that's meant to make people feel better about themselves and their own mortality. And I was hoping to get your response to that.
I think the first thing that comes to me when I hear you say that is that a lot of the stories of that religion sells appears to me to make us feel less good about ourselves.
You mean like heaven and hell?
You know, rather than making us feel better about ourselves. Make us feel more judged, more concerned about our natural urges, our natural loves, you know, more self-conscious, as if there's some kind of authority out there who's watching us all the time. So I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure it functions quite that way.
I totally agree. You know, for example, the day of judgment, the Islamic teachers who are steeped in spirituality say, you know, this is so incongruous of an all-loving, merciful God asking us what did we do when he knows even before we acted. That's why Sufis say, you know, on the day of judgment, we shall say, oh God, plead and advocate on my behalf with yourself. Do what is worthy of you, not what is worthy of me. Then the question of heaven, you know, sensual, luxuriant gardens. But there's a verse in the Quran that says, really, even beyond these gardens of everlasting bliss is the presence of God. There's something more that we yearn for. Hell, you know, scorching fire, boiling water. But there's a verse that says, hell is your mother, meaning it's like the womb of your mother. It's not a place of punishment. It's a place of purification. Those who haven't done the work have a second chance in purifying themselves and being delivered anew. So I see more joy, more hope in those metaphorical descriptions than in the literal descriptions.
Judaism has less of a focus on the afterlife right. than either of mm-hmm. Islam or Christianity. It's not that there's a belief that there's nothing afterwards. Mm-hmm. It's just that that's not the focus.
Right.
The focus is clearly on ethical, righteous, loving, compassionate acts in this world, and that's difficult enough.
Right.
But there's not the sense of heaven and hell spelled out with as much fervor and as much enjoyment or lack of enjoyment, you know, as there is in other yeah. traditions, and that's an interesting thing.
It is.
There's more of a, you know, like if you want to get to heaven, mm-hmm. Christianity and Islam, mm-hmm. You know, provide greater avenues. If you want to focus almost on life is now.
But just even in Islamic spirituality, for example, there is this very beautiful, beloved female saint named Rabia, 9th century. She was often seen running through the streets of Basra in Iraq with a pail of water in one hand and a torch of fire in the other. What are you doing? She said, you know, I'm really going to quench the fires of hell and set fire to heaven. Because if we perform our acts in this world because of fear or a desire for rewards, we're not living really.
Right.
That's why she has this wonderful verse. She says, oh God, if I worship you for fear of hell, burn me in hell. Mm. If I worship you for love of heaven, deny me the gates of heaven. But if I worship you for you yourself, please, I beg you, begrudge me not your everlasting beauty.
I think this exists in all of our traditions.
Yes.
You know, you used the phrase, are these stories made up? I think that was it.
Well, yeah, the criticism is that people think that people like religion because it makes them feel better. These are stories that make you feel better.
Right, and of course, that is part of the function of religion, is to be reassuring. How it becomes reassuring is another question. But in some ways, I think it has to do with how we make sense of our lives, of life in general, and how we connect to that very important concept that my colleagues have talked about, the greater self. Some people never do. Some people might hope it's out there, but never manage to make the connection, sometimes partly because of what I would think of as a misunderstanding of some of these stories, because religion has been used to manipulate people. There's just no question about it, at small levels and huge imperial levels. But I think that people are often, they don't feel competent or confident enough to say, how does this story connect with the way I make sense of my life? What gives me a sense of meaning and purpose in my life? How does that? Because there is something essentially legitimate about how people do that, assuming that, you know, there's nothing violent or hurtful about it. Sometimes we make sense of our lives in ways that actually do hurt us. Sometimes we don't realize at the time. But I think heaven and hell, I mean, it's a fascinating, potentially very manipulative concept, either one. And we also experience heaven and hell in between birth and death. There's just no question about it. How else would we know what it's about? So I'm leery of those concepts, and I'm much more Jewish, I think. I'd like to be away from those kinds of things.
Really briefly to end, what should the reality of mortality, the reality of the fact that we're all going to die, what impact should knowing that have on our lives?
You know, I love that wonderful verse by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which my brothers have heard many, many times. They know it by heart also. Prophet Muhammad said, Jamal, when you arrived here on earth, everybody was laughing and smiling, but you were crying and crying and crying. Live such a life that when you depart for the other world, everybody around you is crying and weeping, but you are laughing and smiling. I'd like to live such a life. I'd like to think that the knowledge of death is going to motivate me to live like that.
And I think it should be seen as an invitation to live as fully as possible in the best possible way, not like somebody else, you know. And let's get out from under all the shoulds that are, you know, the product of parent-child relationships. But as adults, we should see religion and spirituality and the reality of death in a context that says there are terrific opportunities, and you, whoever you are, have some way to live into those things.
Hmm. Ted, final word?
Most of the time we ask, is there life after death? I think the more crucial question is there life after birth? And how do we feed and support, nurture and nourish the fullness of the life that we are living, you know, so that we are in the moment and that we are able to open to and express greater compassion and greater love and bring healing and ask the question, how can I make things better here? Not accumulate more for myself and not make things give me more power or more fame or whatever it is, but how can we legitimately make it better for each other? And I think that focus takes care of the issue of heaven and hell, because if we're living in heaven now, we don't have to worry.
Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. With him is Imam Jamal Rahman, co-founder, Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. And Pastor Don McKenzie is the former minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. Together, they're the three interfaith amigos, and they join us every month. Thanks, all three of you, for coming in.
Thank you so much, Katie.
This is Weekday.
KUOW's Katie Sewell. You can hear more conversations with the three interfaith amigos at KUOW.org. Just search for amigos. Dr. Chris Frizanki works with the State Department, and she's based in Afghanistan. She's a Seattle native who graduated from Garfield High School. Now she works on educating young women in Afghanistan. We'll talk with Dr. Frizanki in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's Theater's production of The Edge of Peace. A mystery surrounds a community when a beloved World War II soldier is reported missing in action, February 28th through March 17th. Tickets and info at sct.org.
44 degrees in Seattle. It's mostly cloudy, but we are getting an occasional sunbeam coming through. Forecast says it's going to wind up partly sunny, and we're looking at an afternoon high of 49.
Support for KUOW comes from the State Utilities and Transportation Commission's Consumer Helpline, helping residents with questions about phone, energy, or water service, providing answers to billing disputes, service complaints, disconnections, and more. 888-333-WUTC.
943. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A lot of folks write poetry to deal with hard times. John Borling did that. He wrote poetry while imprisoned for over 6 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. Major John Borling joins us to share some of that poetry in 40 minutes.
So two stories about war and its impact on people, then. Chris Frizanki coming up and John Borling in about half an hour. Civilian deaths in Afghanistan dropped 12% in 22. That's the first time that figure has fallen in 6 years. That's according to a United Nations report. There were fewer suicide bombings, a decline in aerial attacks, and less ground fighting between pro-government and militant forces, and reportedly the government forces taking more efforts to minimize harm to civilians. Down, but of course still substantial, and civilians are still dealing with the attacks from both the Taliban, other anti-government sources, and from the government and U.S. forces. Of course, U.S. forces scheduled to be leaving Afghanistan soon, but the State Department and its efforts will continue. Dr. Chris Frzonski is a State Department public diplomacy officer in Helmand, Afghanistan. She's also a Seattle native. She graduated from Garfield High School, and she has a firsthand account of Afghanistan today and her work in Afghanistan. Public diplomacy is outreach to Afghans from the State Department.
I'm really lucky because public diplomacy touches pretty much everything our civilian team is doing. That can range from agriculture to women's rights to building roads or training Afghan military to take over their own security. So I really get to see the whole range of the work of our team. And I get to see, you know, I get to see the victories, the big ones, the small ones that go on here every day. There's really not a typical day in Afghanistan, but I've had some pretty good days. Let me give you an example. Just recently, I got to walk through the grounds of a 1,000-year-old stone fortress in Helmand. This is one of Afghanistan's most important archaeological sites, probably a place most Americans have never heard of, much less visited. And I got to go just because we had given some grant money for them to do some restoration work on the site. That was a good day. Another day, I got to join a trip to a very remote place in Helmand where I watched as a legal expert from Afghanistan told village women there what their rights were, what the Quran said, and what the Afghan constitution said. And watching these women take in this information and watching their eyes open and watching their enthusiasm, that was remarkable. It was the first time that training had ever been offered in such a faraway place. And that was a great day, too.
How does it?
Just for perspective, you know, Helmand is the biggest province in Afghanistan. And it's about half the size of Washington State. And, you know, these military civilian teams, like the one I'm part of, we've been doing this kind of work in partnership with the Afghans for 10 years now. So I'm a relatively late comer to this, but it's a huge undertaking, and it's a very exciting job to have.
Dr. Chris Frzonski is a public diplomacy officer in Helmand. How did that training set with the conservatives and the Taliban, who are still operating in and around Helmand province?
Well, obviously there are still huge challenges when it comes to the rights of women in Afghanistan. I wouldn't say that it's been an easy transition, but it's great to see that in the last decade, Afghan women have really come out of the total seclusion that was imposed during the Taliban. And as I say, trainings like this and activities like what we can do with our Afghan partners, that's what really makes progress possible.
You know, Hamid Karzai was saying security in Helmand was better before the British troops showed up. You've also had the roadside bomb killing 7 in Helmand province. The war is still raging there. Where's the American troop presence at this point?
Well, Steve, I'm not an expert on military operations. I have a different sphere of work. I see a lot of progress in security, and I can see it in the way Afghans are working together and working with us. You know, I work long hours, and I work sometimes 7 days a week, but the Afghans I know are working harder. And I think that's because they really feel there's a stake in making things work here. So that's my answer to you. I don't talk about security issues. I live with it every day. But I wouldn't be here if I didn't believe in it.
But there are still American troops in that area that you're in too, right? Hence being at Camp Leatherneck.
Yeah, I'm surrounded by Marines.
Yeah. So the plan is that a lot of those Marines will be gone in a year. What do your partners say about that? What are their concerns?
Well, Helmand is like everywhere else. We're in the middle of transition. We're putting in place normal relations between us and Afghanistan. So in my work, that means programs that used to be more American-led or coalition-led are now Afghan-led. You know, radio broadcasters in Helmand, they get their budgets from their own governments. Schools do the same. Agriculture programs do the same. Law enforcement, infrastructure projects like roads or the Kajaki Dam. That's really the whole goal here, a transition to Afghan leadership. So that's what Karzai, I think, was talking about in Washington when he said to that audience at Georgetown University, he says, the wheel of progress is moving forward and there's no going back. I really see that myself right here.
What's the State Department plan over the next 2 years and beyond for partnering with or funding the kind of programs you're working on now?
What this means, what transition really is all about, is relations between us and Afghanistan becoming normalized. And that means the international community and the United States works with Afghanistan so that it stands on its feet and it can play a part in this region and do what it needs to do for its own people. That's what I do here. That's why I work here. That's what I believe in.
Dr. Chris Fazanke is a public diplomacy officer in Helmand. She's also a Seattle native, and that's why we're talking to you, because you went to high school at Garfield. So tell me, compare and contrast Garfield High School to the work you're doing there. I know that's a big stretch, but you know, do you see any similarities in your high school work to what you see you're doing in Helmand Province? The people you're working with?
That's a great question. You know, there were days in high school where we had to dress up and perform like a diplomat, and I guess I have those days here. And then there were other days where we got to be outside in jeans and really get something done. So that same pattern has served me well. Sometimes I feel a long way from Seattle, but most of the time I really feel like coming from that place has taught me what I need to do my job here.
Really? All the warring groups inside Garfield? All the different cliques?
Well, look, as I said, sometime, again, it's going to be time for me to look like a diplomat in a suit again. But for the moment, working here in Helmand, it's the job of a lifetime. I wouldn't have missed it.
Do you dress in hijab and cover your face when you go out into the community?
When I have meetings or engagements with Afghans, I do what women do here to show respect. I wear a scarf over my head. And that's part of my role here, is to be an effective communicator. And I don't want anything to stand in the way. So, yeah, I put on a scarf over my head.
You know, the fear is that when everybody's gone and Afghanistan is struggling for its independence against the pressures of Pakistan and Taliban, that women's rights will again be subsumed. Do you think enough minds have been changed or enough women empowered in some way that they can fend off the more conservative pressures to return to the older ways?
From what I see here, and let's face it, this is one of the more conservative areas in Afghanistan, I think the answer is yes. I see a lot of growth and I see a lot of progress. And what I'm able to see every day is women taking their daughters to school and taking positions in government and finding ways to have a voice and play a role in Afghanistan's next decade. So, yeah, I think it's going to work.
Chris Fazanke is a State Department public diplomacy officer in Helmand, Afghanistan, also a Seattle native. She works on educating young women in Afghanistan as the U.S. begins withdrawing its troops. Feel like a hike? It's kind of reasonable weather today, so why not, Michael Fagan? Why not take a hike today?
I agree with you. Why not? I'm hoping to finish up some work and get out and get some exercise. We have two hikes. I actually should say one hike and one ski. So the first trip is a hike into Wind Farm out in eastern Washington. A lot of people are saying, boy, I'd like to just go for a hike and not deal with snow and get a bunch of sun. So this first trip will send you off to Kittitas, right outside of Ellensburg, the Wild Horse Wind Farm. It's about an hour and a half drive from Bellevue, and there'll be plenty of sun today and Wednesday and early Thursday, but not on Friday and Saturday. One of the benefits also is this: it's a gated road walk. There's no traffic allowed through there in February and March, and the numbers are reasonable. It's a 3.5 mile hike, one way, mostly flat. And when you get to the high spot, you can see the Columbia River and some of the snow-covered hills in the area. This is a desert hike, but it is still winter, so bring your layers because it will be cool. Highs in the mid-40s in that area for today and tomorrow, and the winds can get quite strong because it is a wind farm.
Yeah, it gets kind of chilly out there, but you have some pictures of some nice cactus blooming.
That's right, and actually that cactus was from last year.
Ah, you fooled me.
It's a teaser. You could take the hike now, not see the flowers, or you come back late April and May when the flowers return. For this hike, you'll need a Discover Pass. Now, some of my skiing friends, Marie and Randy, were telling me, why are you suggesting a hike when Snoqualmie Pass is going to get 8 to 12 inches of snow on Friday and Saturday? So we also put a link to the Nordic Center at Snoqualmie Pass. They have groomed trails, and with all the new snow for Friday and Saturday, you can do that on those days and go for a hike in the desert on Wednesday. And for the Snoqualmie Pass Nordic Center, they have a pass that you can buy a day pass to ski there, and it's Green Trails Map 207S. So we have two wonderful trips. And the weather for the city, we're looking at dry weather for today, a chance of a shower late on Wednesday, and then later on Thursday, rain, and rain Friday and Saturday for the city.
Real rain, huh?
Real rain. No, not just the scattered shower. So Friday looks like the wettest day for the city, and like I mentioned, plenty of snow in the mountains for Friday and Saturday, so plan accordingly.
Sounds lovely.
So, yeah, if you want to burn off a bunch of calories, you could go in the Wind Farm on Wednesday and go skiing Saturday.
By the way, that link Michael Fagan was talking about is at hikewashington.net. We have a link at kuow.org. Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather LLC, and he gives us good hikes to match the week's weather forecast. And you can find links and information of these hikes and past hikes at hikewashington.net. All right, I'll think about not getting out today, but I hope everybody else gets out. Sounds like fun. I hope you get out.
I'm working on it.
All right. Talk to you again next week. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Michael. Well, I won't talk to him next week because I'm going to be off for a couple weeks, but that's later. I'll tell you that later. First, let's listen to some stuff.
And now, the sound of the day.
Those are sounds from an evening at Open Fencing at Soleil Ariel, Seattle's main fencing club. You're hearing about 40 people fencing and a bunch more chatting while they're getting ready or waiting for their turn. And if you listen really close, you hear a beeping sound under all the other noise. That's the sound of the scoring machines registering a hit. Thanks again to weekday listener Paul Fly for sending that in. So what sounds are you hearing? What sounds are you participating in? Our world is full of sounds, and if you pay attention, you're going to hear them, and then you can share them with us. Tell us a story that goes with those sounds. 30 seconds, email it to us. Put sound of the day in the subject line, weekday at kuow.org. We want to hear what your world is sounding like, just like Paul did. We've been to a fencing club already, haven't we? En garde. We're going to talk about dancing next. I bet there's some great dance sounds you could record at some of the dance clubs. And surviving the Hanoi Hilton with poetry. And we'll head on over to the Stomptish, the chat room, a little later.
President Obama spoke out this morning on the impending sequester and warned of dire consequences. That's in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Photograph 51 is the nickname given to an X-ray image of DNA taken in 1952. Photograph 51 is also the title of a play about the woman who made that image, Rosalind Franklin. I'm Marcy Silman. Join me March 2nd for Seattle Repertory Theater's matinee show of...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.